This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan. A couple of weeks ago on this show, I spoke to Kira Yusri of Undi 18 and Sharan Raj of Party Socialist Malaysia on people, protests and power. And in our conversation, Sharan brought up an interesting point about how our entire electoral system is flawed in its conception that the British's first-past-the-post system that we still use in Malaysia to this day is unfair to the people and does not encourage diversity in our political space. Now, this is something we've heard many, many times in the past. So on today's show, I'm going to be speaking with Yap Ming Yao, who's a researcher at Undi Saksama, an initiative that challenges gerrymandering and malapportionment and pushes for each Malaysian citizen's vote to be of the same value. Welcome to the show, Ming Yao. To kick things off, perhaps you can give us an overview of the first-past-the-post system. What exactly is it and how does it work?
Thanks for having me on. So I think the easiest way we can describe how the first-past-the-post system works is with an example. Mm-hmm. So let's say we have a seat and we have, you know, three candidates who are running in it. There's A, B and C. A wins, let's say, 36% of the vote. B wins 34%. C wins 30%, let's say. What happens in the first-past-the-post system is that A will win, despite A only getting 36% of the vote because he's first-past-the-post, or she is first-past-the-post, and they, as they have the most number of votes, they'll win. This is the case even though, as we can see, they didn't get a majority at all.
So this is a winner-takes-all system.
Yeah. For me personally, I think we need to look at the context that we need to look at the context of Malaysia and the type of system that we need here, keeping in mind that none of the alternatives are perfect. First past the post is definitely not perfect in and of itself. But the alternatives, such as, you know, maybe a two-round voting or proportional representation, they're not perfect either. I don't like first past the post for what it is, but okay, I think it's the least bad option.
What would you say is the biggest flaw or the biggest problem with the first past the post system?
Definitely the fact that it can result in situations where it's not representative. So what happens here is we're trading off the need for proportionate representation, which is the name of the other system, but that's exactly what we're trading off here, because we want to prioritize strong and stable governments. But as we can see, that hasn't even happened in Malaysia. We can see this with, I think there are concrete examples we can pull up to show, because when I talked about my example just now with A, B and C, that wasn't just an abstract example. We see in seats like in Gerai in Kedah, in 2018, Pakatan Harapan won 32.9%, BN won 33.1%, PAS won 33.9%. So you have three parties, especially in multi-corner fights, where the winner is a winner that 60% of voters didn't want.
If you put it that way, you know, it's a winner that, you know, 60+% of the voters didn't want, then why did the British come up with this system? I'm wondering if the system in and of itself is rigged against the common person, you know, in its conception for the benefit of, you know, aristocrats or the elites, or if it's a good system that's perhaps not executed as well in Malaysia.
That's a good question. I think it's a bit of both, to be honest, because we go back to 57, right? Post-colonial state, Malaya, at the time, you see a need for, you know, to form, like I said, strong and stable governments. You want a government that's able to possibly get the two-thirds majority in case you want to amend the constitution. You want a government that's able to effectively govern. But at the same time, we have a lot of literature that suggests that the British weren't just thinking about, you know, wonderful values like, you know, good governance and things like that. They saw it as a familiar system because they use it in their own country. It's still used, first past the post is still used in the UK today. And for their goals at the time, which was to transfer power to certain groups that they did want in power, that was why they ended up choosing it in the end. So I think it was a bit of both. And of course, if we look back, it was, of course, supported by UMNO, MCA, and MIC, this first-past-the-post system. But at the same time, we can't ignore as well, of course, the fact that they thought it was something that was simple and something that would lead to stable governments.
The tagline of Undi Saksama is Satu Rakyat, Satu Undi, Satu Nilai, which translates pretty much to one citizen, one vote, one value. Is that not the case right now?
When we think about one person, you know, one vote, the first things we think about are quite simple, you know. women have the right to vote as well, as they should, very clearly. The franchise was one. People, everyone above the age of 18 is allowed to vote. There's no, nobody gets two votes, as was once the case in the UK. Quite funnily, if you owned multiple pieces of land, you could vote multiple times. Or if you attended a certain university, you could vote multiple times, which is quite characteristic of the UK, very feudal. But in Malaysia, the issue here is this is where we bring malapportionment and this is where we bring gerrymandering in. So it's always a bit convoluted to explain, but the best way I've tried to come up with it is when you have seats of different sizes, let's say you're in a seat and I'm in one seat, your seat has 10 people, my seat has 100 people. Both our seats are going to send one person to the Dewan Rakyat anyway, so one MP to the Dewan Rakyat. But your vote is automatically stronger than mine because there's less people in your seat. If there's only 10 people in your seat and there's 100 in mine, my vote affects who becomes MP by about 1%. Yours affects it by 10%. That is obviously an extreme example, but we see this with state seats and federal seats all across the country. Let's look at Damansara. It was increased from an electorate of 84,000. Increased to 150,000. So the entire electorate in the seat, 150,000 people voting. And it's one of the biggest parliamentary constituencies in Selangor. We see this as well with, Bangi, about 146,000. Klang is a really big one, about 136,000. So all of these, Damansara, 150K, Klang, 136K, Bangi, 146K. You compare this with other seats in the same state. So we're not going to go to different states. We're not going to look at that. We look at different seats in the same state of Selangor.
Right.
You look at, for example, Tanjung Karang, 42,000. Sabah Bernam, 37,000. Sungai Besar, 42,000. So Sungai Besar has about 42,000 voters. Where you go back to Damansara, 150,000. My maths is not very good, but that seems to me about, what, three times bigger?
Yeah.
That could have been three seats.
So how does that happen?
So it happens because you have a first-past-the-post system. If you shift boundaries and you make some seats very, very large, it's very easy for you to affect who gets to win elections. We can see this in the statistics in terms of the difference between the amount of votes you win, the percentage of votes you win, versus how many seats you win. What I think is happening here is that the Electoral Commission, who is responsible for this, they may not be sufficiently independent. In my opinion, we need machinery like this. We need civil machinery like this to be independent so that they can do their jobs without any influence from governments.
What exactly do you mean by gerrymandering and malapportionment?
So we separate the two. Mm-hmm. Malapportionment is first where what I talked about just now, where you have different seats, but one is significantly bigger, one is significantly smaller than the other. The interesting fact about this is once upon a time, we did in our constitution have safeguards for this. So we used to say that each seat can only deviate from the average in the state, I think it was, but there was an average. You cannot be 15% more or 15% less, which sounds fair enough because mm-hmm. then you can't make a seat that's too big. But then over time, it was watered down. This became 33%, one third, and 33%. And right now, we amended it multiple times, and now we don't have a limit at all. So you can have a seat as large as you want or as small as you want. And what happens, like we said just now with the example of the 100 voters and the 10 voters, is that when you have small seats, the voters' votes in those small seats matter more because they can influence the outcome more. And in the big seats, it matters less. Some people will go as far as to say that if you stay in a seat with, 150,000 voters, is your vote really going to make that much of a difference, especially if it's a seat that's strong and stable, been held for a long time, as opposed to one that's small and that might be contested, three or four ways. So that's done through a process called redelineation, which is just a fancy word for drawing of boundaries. It's actually quite simple. Someone just draws the boundaries. And the authority that does this is, like we said just now, the Election Commission. And it's one of their duties, as laid out by the Constitution.
What about gerrymandering then?
So gerrymandering is a bit more insidious. Malapportionment is fundamentally about size. Gerrymandering is fundamentally, I think, about shape, which is quite a tricky concept to wrap your head around. I know, because it took me a long time to wrap my head around it. So it's when you take seats and you craft them in such a way that they benefit some political parties over the others. And this is done, one, for political purposes, so that let's say you have three seats and in each seat you have maybe an equal distribution of voters for party A and party B, but you can change the shape of the seats so that, all of a sudden you have a majority of voters for your party in this seat. then of course you're going to win that seat. And a clear way we can see this, and we see this from an NGO in Malaysia called Tindak Malaysia, which specializes in this kind of stuff, is you can see where local ties, so maybe, you know, two kampungs or two neighborhoods or two tamans, which have nothing to do with each other, will get put into the same seat. You can see this with weird shapes happening on our electoral maps, where you look at things that don't make sense. Sometimes you have seats that cut across highways. Sometimes you have seats where tamans or neighborhoods side by side with each other should really look like they're in the same seat, but they're not. And the obvious implication there is that gerrymandering is happening.
Now, when we talk about redelineation, why does our constitution allow it in the first place?
People aren't static. So, for example, you have the easiest example to point out is urbanization. You know, when you have people migrating from places to places, the amount of voters in each place will grow or they'll shrink, and you'll need to compensate for that by redelineating, by changing your seat boundaries every few years or so. It's no less than 8 years from the last review. And I think we can see this. Every state in Malaysia, I think as of right now, is more than 50% urban already. I think Kelantan was the last state to join the club. The second reason I can think of is rural weightage, which is something that was explicitly talked about in discussions when they were deciding on redelineation. The obvious fear is that when you have people in cities, which are and urban areas, a lot more of them there, if you cut out the seats the same size, you very simply what's going to happen is that if you have urban seats of the same size, people from those areas will just dominate over people from those rural areas. So there is also something to be said for making those areas, for having more voters in seats that are urban, purely because there's more of them there and you want to allocate equal interests. The third thing I can think of is that situations in Sabah, Sarawak and Malaya are not the same. One, clearly because of population differences, and two, clearly because I, as someone from KL, really doesn't know better than someone from Sarawak or Sabah how to run things in their states. So I think there are a lot of reasons for making sure the redelineation happens. It's so that your seats are current. It's so that your seats are take into account, you know, realities on the ground.
And is this why in the past we've seen political parties that have won the popular vote lose the elections as a whole? For one example I can bring up is Barisan Nasional in 2013. They lost the popular vote by 300,000 to 400,000, but still retained power.
Let me just qualify this. Even if you had a perfect system where there was no gerrymandering, no malapportionment at all, it would still be possible in a first-past-the-post system. I think it wouldn't be logically impossible. But the fact of the matter is that in Malaysia, it's very, very strikingly clear. I think my favorite statistic about this is, and the one that we always roll out when we talk about how bad the seat sizes are, in order to win an election in Malaysia and form a government, you need 112 seats. You mm-hmm. need a majority of the Dewan Rakyat. So presumably this means you need more than 50% of the votes, right? But as we've seen and as you've pointed out, this doesn't always happen. If you pick your seats correctly and you win the smallest 112 seats, theoretically, you can form a government in Malaysia having won only 39.2% of votes.
We're going to go for a very quick break. I'm speaking with Yap Ming Yao, researcher at Undi Saksama on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Yap Ming Yao, researcher at Undi Saksama, and we are discussing the problems with the Malaysian electoral system and what we can do to fix it. Ming Yao, another problem with the current system is that it doesn't necessarily encourage diversity in our political scene, does it? In an ideal world, you'll have various political parties representing a plethora of ideologies or causes. And as a citizen, one should pretty much vote for the party one relates to the most. That's it. That's how it's supposed to work, right? But what we see happening in Malaysia is that people tend to vote based on strategy, which means in a constituency where there are three parties competing with one another, even if I agree with Parti Burong, I might not end up voting for Parti Burong because my thought process is, well, Parti Burong has no chance of winning. Parti Monyet, for example, has a higher chance of winning. And what's important to me now is the defeat of Parti Serigala. This is a problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this is something that stems from the first past the post system itself, because it incentivizes people to, it incentivizes parties to only have, you know, two strong parties or two strong coalitions, because otherwise you're wasting, you're going to split the vote, and it's going to end up being a lot more uncertain. Two, it incentivizes people to vote for stronger parties, to vote tactically, because as you said, if I really like Parti Burung, but you know Parti Burung is not going to stand a chance at all, I might as well vote for Parti Arnab, which I agree less with, because Parti Serigala is going to win otherwise, and I'll do anything to make sure they don't win. This sort of thing would be less likely to happen in a proportional representation system, for example. So if you take the example we had just now, A, B, and C, 36%, 34%, 30%. There's no point in me voting for Party C if I know that they're not going to win. There doesn't even have to be that high. Let's change the example a bit. If they consistently poll at maybe 3-4%, there's no point in me voting for them. Hmm. But if we were in a proportional representation system, Party A, let's say Party A has 70% of the vote, Party B has 20% of the vote, Party C has 10% of the vote. Okay, I got it right. There's still an incentive for me to vote for Party C, because it's dependent on the percentage that you get the number of seats. So you still get some representation regardless of whether it's lower than usual. And when parties inevitably want to form a coalition, to form a government, they will have to take those concerns, those parties' concerns into consideration, even if they're smaller.
And you brought up something which I think is very, very important, this idea of splitting the vote. Again, in an ideal world, there should be multiple cornered fights between various unique political parties everywhere, in every constituency. But instead, what we get right now is, you know, the right negotiating with the right and the left negotiating with the left before elections. Is this a problem? Because what if I'm in a constituency where my only options are DAP or UMNO, but I'm sitting here thinking, for example, but I relate to Amana, so who should I vote?
Yeah, and then you get the Undi Rosak movement, mm-hmm. or you get other similar movements like that. Yeah, it's definitely an issue. And once again, I think it goes back to the sort of behavior that first past the post incentivizes. Whether I think it's a direct correlation, I genuinely wouldn't say conclusively. I don't think that's a claim that I should be making. But definitely, you see people with, it doesn't encourage diversity, absolutely, because there's no point in contesting an area that you know you're not going to win. Or even worse, in an area where you have a coalition buddy or a coalition partner in there, because what's the point of just splitting the vote? What's the point of just splitting the vote there? And this is the case, even if there might be a substantial amount of people or any amount of people in that seat who align more with one party than the other. It's something that will keep happening as long as we have a winner-takes-all approach to our elections in each seat.
Why is it important to have a diverse and robust political scene with different parties all inside inside parliament, as opposed to maybe two giant coalitions like we see in the US, Democrats, Republicans?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But the easiest thing is the easiest way to look at that is to look at what parliament's function should be. So let's assume, let's disregard, you know, the many shortcomings of our parliament at the moment, including the fact that it doesn't exist. But if you had, you know, a more diverse range of parties, the first thing I can think of is democratic legitimacy, because these are parties that a lot of people will agree with, but they simply don't get their voices to be heard because of the system we have right now. The second thing we have is impact on the lawmaking process. Parliament is at its core a legislative body. It makes laws, in theory at least. And you have things that go on within it, like debates. You have members bringing up their own, you have the concerns of their constituencies. You have members bringing up the concerns that and the positions that they were voted in because of. I think we would see a far better legislative process if we had a more diverse range of parties. Even if those parties don't agree all the time, it's because they don't agree all the time that we get this that we get more compromise, that we get taking into consideration different viewpoints of people in this country, rather than just, oh, these are these two big coalitions, they all voted for us. In some cases, like you pointed out, because they have no other choice but to do that in order to get what they want. And because of that, that's our mandate. It's just black versus white. It's just red versus blue.
What then can we do about it? How do we go from the kind of winner-takes-all system to a system where parliament is robust, various parties championing different causes? How do we get to that? How do we break the system or fix the system that's already broken?
So it's sad to say, but I think changing first past the post itself will be extremely difficult. Like, to be completely frank with you, mm-hmm. I think any party that does it or any government that does it while they're in power will obviously be subject to accusations that they're doing this to benefit themselves. Further, the average person and your and our impact on, you know, the lawmaking process as of right now, the need for first past the post is not set out in the constitution. It's set out. It's our constitution specifies one member per seat, and it specifies, you know, a lot of other things, but it doesn't necessarily lead to first past the post. It's when you read that together with the Elections Act that we get a first past the post system. So you'd have to amend that, which once again, you have to petition your MPs to do, and it's quite hard to get your MPs to do something that are against their own interests. I think a more realistic way, perhaps, would be to push for reforms within the first-past-the-post system. This is, of course, ignoring the fact that there are many inherent flaws in first-past-the-post, but we could try to push for more things, reforms to parliament itself. For example, in other countries which use the same style of parliament as us, Westminster style, which is just a fancy way of saying inherited from the colonial British, they have, you know, parliamentary committees. They have more private members' bills. We don't have that. They have things like the House of in the upper house, or in our case, the Dewan Negara, taking a more active role instead of just being a bit of a rubber stamp or a way to get people into cabinet. We have things like more debates going on. In some countries, you have prime minister's question. All of these things, in my opinion, will genuinely improve the legislative process and lead to better outcomes. We push for an independent EC, which is something that many, many groups have been pushing for, like, I think over the past decade. They've pushed for that so they're able to do their jobs without political influence from parties. We raise awareness about how dire the situation is right now. And I don't use that word sparingly because, like we said, there are statistics. You can see really how much this is impacting people's votes right now. And even if the concepts of gerrymandering and malapportionment, let's be honest, they're a mouthful. They take some explanation. If I think there are concrete examples we can use, like, for example, why is your seat 3 times bigger than mine? Why is, you know, why is your seat shaped so weirdly, cutting across a highway with these weird borders that don't really make sense? You push those things, get more people to realize that this is actually impacting their ability to vote, and this is directly impacting the democratic process. Push for an independent EC so that they can redelineate without political influence. I think they'll go a really, really long way.
One thing that a lot of people seem to suggest is something called ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting. What can you tell me about this? How is this different from first past the post?
So in those types of voting, you do not... So the first thing to make sure, to make clear, is that it's not a winner-takes-all mode. So you see this in different countries. For example, you have France, places like New Zealand, where there's a very broad range of ways you can do this. There's ranked voting, where you can do preferences based on who you want most. So I want this candidate first, I want this candidate as my second choice, I want this candidate as my third choice. You can have multiple rounds, so like 2 rounds of voting. So if nobody gets a certain majority in the first round, which is first past the post, then you take the top two and you put them into a second round. I think that's what they do in France, not mistaken. And to make things even more confusing, I think in some places like Germany, they have mixed models. So they have certain amount of seats that are first past the post, certain amount of seats that are proportional representation. And then to make things even more complex, but the overall outcome must be proportional. There are many, many variations of this, each with their own, of course, variations depending on the exigencies and depending on the needs of the individual country. But the one thing that is clear from all this is, of course, once again, it leads to more diversity. It leads to a more proportionate representation of votes rather than first past the post. However, it can lead to instability. Although the validity of this claim, the validity of this argument against first past the post, I think is a bit qualified, because as you can see in Malaysia, it hasn't led to a particularly strong government or stable government anyway. If we were to implement those systems in Malaysia, I think it would be a bit harder in that regard. So what do I mean by this? Let's say we do 2-round voting. In the first round, 3 parties, candidate A wins a majority. That's straightforward. Mm-hmm. Same thing happens in the next seat. Candidate A doesn't win a majority, so him and candidate B move on to the second round. But candidate A got the most votes. Round 2, candidate B gets the most votes. And so candidate B gets sworn in. You can see immediately how certain quarters in Malaysia will immediately jump on this. Oh, this is an affront to our democracy. This is people shoehorning in someone they like. With ranked voting, it's even worse because if that can be said. So even worse from a legitimacy standpoint, because then you'll have something that is so complex that it is going to be nearly impossible to explain it to every single person in Malaysia. The one biggest strength of first past the post I can see is that it's simple. Whoever wins the most gets in. Simple. And if there's any irregularities, it's if counting those. With ranked, you take into account factors such as who's getting the most first, and then you see who's the preferences involved in that. It takes a while as well, because the people within the civil machinery who need to calculate votes will take a while to look at all the preferences as well. And that, so it might be weeks before you have an outcome for some elections, leading to more, you know, potential for people doing not so nice things. All of those factors will compound, in my opinion. Although, as I said, no system is perfect. It's just a matter of, you know, pros and cons.
On that note, thanks so much for speaking with me today, Ming Yao.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me on.
That was Yap Ming Yao, researcher at Undi Saksama, talking to me about our broken electoral system and what we can do to fix it. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app or bfm.my. I'm Dashran Johan, and you've been listening to Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.